I'd like to say a little bit more about our theology of work and how we got to a place where we are today from the biblical teaching. If the Bible's as clear as what Tom and I presented and the way we think it is, how did we get to a place historically where we are today where we have some of the difficulties that we've had in our churches and seminaries getting this emphasized correctly, and how do we get to a place where there is this hierarchy of callings that exists in our churches today? So I'd like to just reflect a little bit on that historically. I'm not a church historian by training, but I think I know enough about it to just reflect intelligently on that. And then I'd like to shift gears a bit and just say a little bit, Greg, I so appreciate the what you did in both of yours, more at the 35,000 foot level, which is, I think, incredibly helpful stuff. I'd like to see if we could take some of that and bring it to put a little more shoe leather on that for theological educators and talk about some of the reasons that I think pastors can really benefit from being more literate and more informed on matters of economics and how that translates into the fabric of the local church. So I'd like to, I hope this turns out to be a compliment to some of the remarks that you've made. Now, just to briefly summarize, we were yesterday concluded that all legitimate work in the marketplace is an arena of service to Christ, where the very work itself is a significant part of what constitutes a person's service. We talked about how, as Chuck Colson put it, we are hardwired for work as part of our spiritual DNA, and what gives our work its intrinsic value is how it works out the image of God in our lives. And if that's true, the way we talk about these things, I think, really matters. I think if we can avoid talking about people going into, quote, full-time ministry, if we can avoid talking about using the term ministry without some sort of qualifier indicating the arena of service, I think if we can just change the language, I think we're significantly far ahead. Now, let me. I just want to reflect a bit on how we got to where we are today. It seems to me that a lot of this begins. I'm not sure I want to be quoted on the exact origin of this, but it seems to me the roots of this, as far as I can tell, go back to the Aristotelian distinction between the active and the contemplative life. Greg brought out Aristotle's contempt for working people. I think part of the reason for that was because in the way Aristotle viewed the best part of the good life was that you gave yourself to a life of contemplation, and that was a big part of what he defined as the highest good. Aristotle held that giving attention to that contemplative part of life is what enabled human beings to fulfill their highest good and their highest purpose. It was actually, I'd say, this was one of a handful of factors that contributed to widespread skepticism about commerce and business in the ancient world to begin with. I think there are other things that contributed to that. It seems to me one of the things that we'll touch on in a minute is that in many cases that the economic system was so fraught with corruption and oppression that there were very few ways in the ancient world to actually achieve wealth without being involved in some sort of, either faith compromising or otherwise more immoral means by which that was done. This is why it seems to me in the ancient world the wealthiest people were overwhelmingly the ones who had abused their power or engaged in some sort of oppression or immoral means in order to do that. So that, I think, Aristotle's philosophy, I think, was a part, not the whole, but a part of the contribution to that skepticism about the workplace and especially working with your hands and the kind of active life that he contrasted with his contemplative life. Now, to fast forward a bit into the Middle Ages, and it seems to me that one of the things, this is a little bit oversimplified on this, but one of the things that it eventually created was somewhat of a hierarchy between the monastery and the marketplace in medieval times. Now, we should be, to be fair, it's right to point out that many of the monasteries were also very successful businesses at the same time. And sort of in some of our Catholic brothers and sisters have taken some exception to this stark dichotomy. But I think in general, I think it's fair to say that in the medieval world, there was a significant dichotomy between the people who inhabited the monasteries and the people who inhabited what they would call the secular workplace. Now, part of this is I think what the reformers ended up reacting to, and their notion not only of the believer priest but also of justification by faith ended up being I think a very strong reaction to this dichotomy. One of the numerous things that the 95 Theses objected to and what the reformers objected to was this notion that by being cloistered in the monastery, you were actually contributing to the good works that were necessary to ensure your salvation. And so the idea of justification by faith alone, I think, drove a stake right in the heart of that medieval clericalism. And Luther and Calvin's insistence that there were no good works that were either necessary or worthwhile to merit one's salvation the way that came out is that you didn't have to be cloistered in order to be saved or to be further down the road toward meriting your salvation. Now, to be clear. Luther, I think especially, was really clear that even though God did not need our good works in order to merit our salvation, our neighbors certainly did. And so our good works were still important, and I think that was articulated well. But I think Luther inadvertently, I think, planted the seeds for this dichotomy to reemerge again with his notion of the two kingdoms. Where he put the world of work and the world of the marketplace in what he called the left hand of God. And I think that where that was placed, I think, re-sowed the seeds to see this dichotomy between the, quote, the ministry and the marketplace re-emerge again. Now, Luther, in his own characteristic way of putting this, when he sort of put aside this idea that there was any special spiritual merit that was given to being cloistered in the monastery, he argued that all of the professions, there was such a thing as a worldly calling, and that your vocation was what God was calling you to do in the world, could actually be worked out in the world, which, I mean, the surprise was that was actually a fairly new concept around the time of the Reformation. He said, even the hangman brings honor to God if he does his job well, assuming, of course, a particular view of the death penalty, I realize. But that Luther, the way he put it, he said, each one must attend to the duties of his own calling, whether they be a cobbler, tailor, farmer, prince, hangman, or constable. And Calvin, I think, echoed this well when he put it that the whole world is a theater of God's glory, which I think suggests that Calvin even put it that politics was an arena in which God could be glorified. I'm not convinced that he was in my home state of California for that. But what it suggested here is that we rightly look back at the reformers for abolishing the notion that that priests, nuns, and monks had callings and everybody else had jobs to support them. What I don't think we readily see is how the seeds for that were inadvertently replanted. And so the combination of that plus what I would consider to be more recently, what I would call our evangelical pietism, I think, has reinforced this dichotomy, and we've simply changed the way we talk about this. It's not being cloistered in order to help bring you further down the road to merit salvation. We have substituted the notion of eternal significance for meriting our salvation. And I think it's very common among my students to hold that if you are employed by a church or a parachurch organization where you are directly involved in evangelizing and discipleship, those are the things that have eternal significance. And what goes on in the workplace are the things that support those things. But I think it's very rare in my experience that Christian business people, Christians working in the professions, Christians working in blue-collar work, see their work as having any eternal significance whatsoever. I think they see that as totally separate from their contributions to God's kingdom. And that's why I so appreciate your distinguishing yesterday between the institutional church and advancing the kingdom. And I think that's right to see whenever God's people are obedient to him and representing him in whatever sphere of influence we're in, that is a part of advancing the kingdom. It's 'cause that, I take it, the kingdom involves the rule of God advancing in the world. And so to confine the notion of eternal significance to what the reformers, I think, would have called clerical work, I think we've missed one of the great legacies of what Luther and Calvin originally had in mind. So what they argued is that because your works were not necessary for your justification, that there was nothing inherently superior about clerical work in terms of putting one farther down the road toward meriting eternal life. Now, again, Luther has his own characteristic way of putting this. He made the point, I think, in graphic terms, that changing a diaper is just as holy as teaching a Sunday school lesson, and that God does not need our good works, our neighbor does, not to impress God, but to actually love our neighbor. So what I'd want to be really careful about is that we understand what it is that brings eternal significance to things. I think in many of my students, I think they will tell me that, well, the only two things that last forever are the Word of God and the souls of human beings. And the implication they make from that is that, therefore, the only two things that have eternal significance are the things that are invested in those two specific areas. And I try to tell them that's a logical fallacy, that doesn't necessarily follow from that. And if it's true that what people in the workplace are doing is God's work in the world, analogous to what pastors are doing in the local church and missionaries are doing on the mission field, then those things have eternal significance as well. And one of the things that I think is missing in our affirmation of the nobility and the dignity of work is this connection to our daily work and the eternal significance that provides. And I think one of the things we need to affirm to the business person, to the professional folks, to the plumbers, to the blue-collar folks in our churches, is that the work they are doing is not part of a world that's going to be annihilated, but it's part of what God is doing to restore and renew the world. And without looking like I'm a post-millennialist on this, I think that's a really significant part of the affirmation of what goes on in the workplace, is the affirmation of eternal significance, that what you do in the workplace matters for eternity. Right? And it's not just how you facilitate other things that count for eternity. I think that's most of the business people I'm aware of in my church, if you ask them, what's the connection between their work and eternity, they will see themselves as instrumental means to an end, not part of the end themselves. And I think that's something, in my view, that's missing in our affirmation of the dignity of work for our professional folks. Okay. Now, let me shift gears a bit and talk a little bit about some of the I think the shoe leather benefits to pastors in the local church. And this is why I tell my students why they need to be attentive to economics on this. So let me just shift gears a bit. This is on the last page there of the outline. You'll get the copy of The Virtues of Capitalism here in a minute. One of the introductory account in the book is recollected by my friend. Yes.
Is this from yesterday, same?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yep. Not sophisticated enough to have two different outlines. But my friend Austin Hill writes, he recounts this in the introduction to the book. About it, the first Acton Institute conference that he went to was when they were still doing these Free and Virtuous Society conferences all over the country, before Acton University actually got started. And he tells a story of it's a small conference, about 15, 20 people in there when he was a grad student. It was all seminary students around the country. And the facilitator posed the following question. He said, "Can somebody name for me one area of our lives that has nothing to do with economics?" And the group thought for a minute, and then this student spoke up in the Southern drawl. I wonder if he was a Southern student, actually. I don't know the answer to that. But he said, "As a Christian, I believe..." I can't do that quite right. I believe that my eternal salvation... Too much going back to my Texas roots. "I believe that my eternal salvation has nothing to do with work in economics." The group was, to say the least, taken aback by that, and the facilitator then rephrased the question and said, "Okay, let's assume that you're right about that. Let's assume one's eternal destiny has nothing to do with work and economics," which in my view is a highly debatable assumption. "Can somebody name a second area of our life that has nothing to do with work and economics?" And there was completely silent. It went on to suggest that every facet of our earthly life is impacted on some level by economic activity and economic conditions. Right? Now, think about how you might answer the question that facilitator posed. I would actually debate the notion that our eternal salvation has nothing to do with work and economics, since the Bible actually describes some of the primary elements of our eternal destiny in starkly economic terms. For example, in Romans 4, when Paul's discussing the notion of justification by faith, salvation is described in terms of an accounting ledger in which your sin on the debit side is forgiven and you have righteousness credited to your account. And the term justification is used to describe the announcement, essentially the proclamation, that righteousness has been credited to your account. As a result of that transaction, in other words, we are declared justified. In fact, to take it a little bit further, when Jesus declared "it is finished" on the cross, that, as you know, is also an accounting term that's literally translated "paid in full" when it refers to our sin. Now, I think a further response to that student who responded to the facilitator would suggest that there is obviously much more to a person's spiritual life than the matter of his or her eternal destiny. Life on this side of eternity matters significantly. And if we refuse to separate out the sacred from the secular and affirm that all of life is spiritual, then I would suggest that there's no area of our spiritual life that's not impacted by work and economics. Okay? Now, in my experience, however, that's not enough. I've tried that with my students. That's not enough to hook them on the need for recognizing why economics, particularly as it relates to human flourishing, is important. Nor is it enough to suggest, as David, I think, brought out yesterday, that economics, far from being the dismal science, is actually shot through with moral issues. Gray pointed out, too, that economics, like politics, is fundamentally about how we order our lives together. Those are fundamentally moral questions, particularly the economic ones, which have to do with the burdens of the burdens and benefits that are divided up among a society's resources. How we allocate those burdens and benefits are fundamentally moral issues that have significant economic overtones. Okay? I found that is also not enough to hook my students on the need to see this area. Maybe it's because we call it economics. I don't know if that, I think that's a part of it too. No offense. And you're just going to have to live with that. I started thinking a lot harder about what are the things that we can do to hook pastors and the next generation of pastors on the need to integrate this into the life of the church. I'm so encouraged to hear what Tom Nelson had to say, and this is, I think, actually, it's Greg and the Economia Network. I think it's actually had an impact on Tom to push him to think about integrating some of these matters of economics into the life of the church. I was very encouraged by that list of economic bullet points that he had, that he's working into the fabric of the life of the church. I think that's very encouraging. And what he's showing us, it seems to me, is that this can be done in ways that are complementary to the other things that are emphasized in the life of the church. Now, we've talked already about connecting the dignity of daily work with pastoral ministry. It seems to me, and I've told my students this too, that if we don't do that, we've lost the battle. In fact, if we can't affirm the dignity and the nobility of the work that the people in our pews are engaged in day in and day out, we've lost the battle to meaningfully integrate their faith with the majority of their lives. So I'm assuming that is a given. But it seems to me that's where it begins. Now, it seems to me one of the clearest ways to bring this into the life of the church on a week-by-week basis is to recognize the economic context of the Bible. And to do that seems to me requires some economic literacy in order to preach and teach the Bible accurately when it comes to matters of economic life. The Bible is shot through with references, allusions, and direct teaching that has to do with how the people of God govern their economic life. In fact, I think it's fair to say the Bible has more to say about our economic life than it does about our eternal destiny. In fact, I think if you actually count up the number of texts that make those references, it's not even close in terms of the total. But it seems to me one of the most important reasons for pastors to be economically literate is so they can preach and teach the Bible accurately. Though it is true that the fundamental issues of economics in the Bible concern the state of a person's heart. I think that's true. And it's also true that the condition of the heart has not changed since the Bible was written. However, it is naive to teach and preach the Bible without taking into account what I consider to be profound differences in economic life between the ancient world and today. I think often we preach and teach the Bible without taking those things into account because we assume that the fundamental matters are matters of the heart and the heart hasn't changed, therefore we can directly apply the biblical teaching on these matters to people today. And I think we miss the huge differences in economic life and what that says about our understanding of the Bible. And how we preach and teach that. For example, it is not uncommon, as you read, and if you haven't read some of the more theologically inclined critiques of the market system, you see a lot of these things come out there. It is not uncommon to apply teachings on subjects as the year of Jubilee as requiring wholesale distribution of wealth. I mean, that is very common in certain theological circles. Seems to me that the year of Jubilee actually has nothing to do with the redistribution of wealth. What it's referring to is a regular redistribution of opportunity to make a living for oneself. It's very common to hear in Acts chapter 2 of the church's sharing of their goods together as being some sort of aid and comfort to forced redistribution of wealth and income. Some of the criticisms of the market system, I'd say, are misreadings of the Bible because of a failure to take into account these really huge differences in economic life between the first century and today. I think, for example, I think this helps account for the what I think is a really stark statement of Jesus, where he says it's harder for a rich man to enter the kingdom than a camel to go through the eye of a needle. I think the primary reason Jesus taught that was though true, the threat of idolatry of money, but I think the main reason for that was that largely it reflected the zero-sum economic arrangement in which it was so difficult for somebody to become wealthy without faith-compromising involvements that they had to get into in order to achieve wealth. It was very unusual for somebody to do well financially and to do good for the community at the same time in the ancient world. And that I think that zero-sum view of economics was characteristic of the ancient world. And I think in many cases you hear it's not only a misreading of the Bible, but I think a misunderstanding of economics that contributes to some of the what I would call misapplications of some of the biblical teaching in this area. Some of the contemporary discussion about inequality today directly reflects a zero-sum view of economic life, which economically simply is not true in the more information-based economies of the world. Now, I think you can make a case that it is true in some parts of the world today, and maybe perhaps some segments of our economy reflect more of a zero-sum arrangement. But to say, let's put it this way: to say that the sort of crude, simplistic statement that the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer implies that, and I think not only implies what's intended, is that the rich are getting richer, and that is causing the poor to become poor, which is a direct reflection of a zero-sum view of economic life, which simply is not true in a good bit of the developed world today. Another example is the common conflation of greed and self-interest. I think is a misreading of Scripture. Another example of this is this misunderstanding based on a zero-sum view of economic life. I think is partly what's at the heart of the increasing demand. You'll see this. It's pretty interesting to watch how these criticisms come to the fore when election seasons are in full swing. But this idea that business is somehow obligated to give back to the community, I've always found to be a troubling concept, because it operates normally under the assumption that the normal conduct of business is somehow an extraction of value from the community rather than a contribution to it. It's quite common for people in our churches, particularly for theologically oriented critiques of the local church, or by the local church of the market economy, to see business as being somehow just in it for themselves, and that greed runs rampant, and that there's no vision of how the normal conduct of business can actually contribute to the common good of the community. So this has actually been helpful for my students to see that being literate in economics will help them become better preachers and teachers of the Bible. And it will keep them from making statements about economic life that are either economically naive or just flat out economically not true. And I think I've encouraged my students regularly to become more familiar with some of the profound differences in economic life between the first century and today, and to use that, to keep that in the back of their minds when they preach and teach on these areas. Here's a second reason that economics is important, seems to me, is that we've mentioned this briefly already, but I want to spell this out a little bit further, is economics is part of the doctrine of creation, particularly the dominion mandate of Genesis 1. It seems to me one of the tasks for our theologians, I wish Greg Allison was here, because I'd get to yell at him in particular on this. one of the tasks for our theologians, it seems to me, is to spell out in much more detail what the economic implications are of the Dominion mandate. There's a lot of very fruitful research to be done here going forward. I love the statement Sir Brian Griffiths he makes. He maintains the Dominion mandate suggests what he calls, quote, responsible wealth creation. That is, human beings are using the wisdom of God that's been engraved into his creation and made available by means of general revelation and common grace. And they exercise creativity, innovation, and the entrepreneurial traits that are a part of human beings being made in God's image. I have a really good example of this. I have a longtime family friend who's retired. He has more money than he knows what to do with. And so he gets asked to do kind of, you know, silent partners, you know, angel capital type things. And he says no to all these things, but he succumbed to one of these just recently, where he's now the chairman of the board for a small company that is marketing a technology that was invented by a Caltech professor. He won the Nobel Prize for it, and as a thoroughgoing academic, all he cared about was the academic recognition for it. And my part of my friend's task on the board is to actually get him interested and attuned to the full commercial application of this. The scientists who invented this actually wanted to give the technology away. And a big part of my friend's task has been to convince him that the best way to get this into the most responsible hands who will actually use the technology most profitably is not to give it away. It's to start a profitable business. And of course, being a thoroughgoing academic, all he cared about was, you know, once he got the Nobel Prize, he was on to something else. He just wanted to give this thing away. And this guy, he's driving my friend, who's a very successful entrepreneur, but he's just driving him nuts. And he constantly has to bring him back down to shoe leather reality. And it's a basic facet of economics that the best way for this technology to get into the hands of the people who will actually use this the most profitably is to actually make it a commercial transaction. Because there's value expressed, which is some of the signals that David, you were talking about, the value that's expressed in actually purchasing the technology is, you know, is one of those signals of someone's seriousness about how they're going to use it and actually make it useful in the long run. So it's been very interesting to watch as part of the exercise of dominion over creation, getting this technology into the most people's hands, it was actually giving it away, being charitable and altruistic, was actually counterproductive to that end. Now, here's a third element that I think this is really helpful. We've made reference to the book When Helping Hurts, but it seems to me an understanding of economics is also important so that churches can productively help the poor. This is what I love about, I'm so glad you got Chris Brooks coming here. This is one of the things he learned early on, is that if he was going to really productively help the people in his congregation who were basically the people who had been left behind in Detroit after everybody had left the city, they had to know some pretty fundamental things about economics. They had to know that work was important, that incentives mattered, that wages counted for something, and that they were responsible for their own economic well-being, and that their success had to be earned in order to have value. These were all things that were basically foreign concepts to many of the people that he was ministering to. And so the message of the gospel, the message of discipleship about actually faithfully following Jesus had a lot to do with becoming economically productive citizens. And these were new concepts to folks. And what Chris had recognized is that the traditional approach of churches coming in and providing basically handouts and doing things for people that they could and ought to be doing on their own was hugely counterproductive. And we're getting that message from all over the world as well. It seems to me that some aspects, some economic literacy is really important in order to help the poor that we serve to become self-supporting instead of more dependent. Now, what am I on, third, fourth, whatever we're on here? It seems to me, a fourth is that pastors need to know something about economics to appreciate profit, prices, and wages for what they are. Remember Bill Pollard, service master, once remarked in a public interview, he said the one sermon he wanted to hear preached that he has never heard is entitled The Virtue of Profit. I think he's still waiting for that. And he it's really interesting to hear him talk about this. He's a very successful business person. He's probably the most theologically astute business person I know. But he challenges academics who condemn profit to ask themselves, where are the buildings in which they teach and office, where they come from, and how they were actually paid for? He reminds academic critics of the market system that profit is what makes altruism possible. Profit is what enables government to provide the services that it does. Now, we might also say it's also debt that provides those services, although that borrowed money also has to come from somebody making a profit somewhere. And I think we've talked about this already, but profit is fundamentally a market signal that tells us how efficiently companies are using its resources. To suggest that there's something inherently problematic with generating profit, even generating large profits, is to misunderstand it as a signal. Profit is like food, suggests the British philosopher Charles Handy in his article, What's a Business For? He said, we have to eat to live, but if we live to eat, he argues, there's something really wrong with that picture. Profit's not the end, but it's a means to the end of accomplishing the service to the community that the company is engaged in. Now, finally, I would suggest that pastors need to pay attention to economics and the marketplace in particular because, so I just briefly mentioned yesterday, the marketplace, it seems to me, is the primary crucible in which we are formed spiritually. I'm going to spell this out just a little bit. I want to take the account, read to you just briefly the account of a failed CEO and what he learned about his spirituality from his business failure. This was a gentleman, he's probably in his mid-40s at the time. He worked for a major telecom company that had an operation. He was in charge of the operation in Brazil. And he had been tasked with signing up millions of customers in a relatively short time period, what he considered to be an almost impossible task. Then when he got there, he realized the funding, the capital that they were counting on was disappearing. They also had very bad news about, they had drastically overestimated the credit worthiness of their customers. And within the first 6 months, roughly 40% of their customers had to be dropped because of their lack of credit worthiness. And he realized that, not only might this thing fail, it might be catastrophic, and it might take their whole organization down. It eventually got so stressful that he had to go to work in a bulletproof car, and it eventually nearly killed him. And here's how he reflects on this. The thing eventually did fail. It didn't take the parent company down, but it came close. Here's what he suggested. He said, through that painful experience, God completely reoriented my perspective of time. He showed me that my call was not to live in my plans for the future or memories of the past, but to be fully present to the present moment. I began to see each moment as a sacrament. It became kind of a second conversion for me. Really remarkable. He uses that kind of conversion language to describe what God was doing in the workplace. The remarkable part was that after coming into this recognition and confessing that I had made achievement my God, which took months to recognize, I came to a place of profound joy and freedom. The truth was, I had made achievement my God. I had lived for the adrenaline rush of success, but had been blind to this truth for decades. As God revealed this reality to me through the pain and failure of my business, it set me free. As much as I pleaded for him to do otherwise, God didn't deliver me from my circumstances. He delivered me through them. Through my joy and surrender to him, Jesus drew me into a profound intimacy with him, with the freedom and joy I had heard about but never really tasted. Out of a darkness that grew blacker than black for me, God brought me into a freedom and lightness of soul I didn't know were possible. It was a country I had only rarely visited before, and it was only for brief periods. I experienced God through the pain of my business failure. Nothing the world has to offer compares to the inexpressible joy that comes from experiencing the tender intimacy with God for which we are designed. He calls the workplace the crucible that God used to shape his soul. And that is what I'm encouraging my students to help their working folks be attentive to. Because that's, in my view, a very profound spiritual formation that happened, as far as I can tell, entirely outside the church building with very little guidance from a pastoral staff. What God worked in and through what went on in the workplace. And I think this kind of stuff is happening every day. And the people we minister to don't even know about it. And I tell my students, unless you're in touch with the kinds of things that our business professional and working place folks are dealing with on a day in, day out basis, you're not in position to help them be in any way attentive to this. It seems to me this is a pretty significant part of the pastoral task, is their spiritual formation. And to ignore the workplace as the crucible for this, that seems to me to be a really glaring omission. And so I think this is not only about economics, but it's about being attentive to what God is doing in and through the workplace. It seems to me this is part of the holy calling that our pastors and seminary students have. Amen? All right, we'll stop here and open it for any discussion. Yes.
Happened in college, it was just a trauma, and he kept it hidden, and then it came out, and instantly he became a minister in the hospitals, and the doctors would call him out to the hospital to talk to people facing other disfiguring or traumatic surgery to say there's life after, because he had a wonderful wife and a daughter, and he had an effective ministry, and he hid it, and then it came out, and he just had a whole ministry, and I really do think that the testimony of having messed up or been wrecked or whatever and gotten through it, and the crucible point is so helpful to people. And I remember I was going through a thing, and Tom Eliff called, and who's been the head of our IMB, and he said, look, you know, it reminds me of the bird that flew into a badminton game, and they mistook him for a shuttlecock and just beat the stuff out of him. And after a number of months, the bird came up and said, how are you doing? And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I don't fly nearly as high as I used to, but when I get off the ground at all, it's ever so sweet. And you know, just the kind of testimony of having gone through something is a great encouragement.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, hail to that guy.
Yeah. Well, see, and I think we probably understate the way virtue is actually formed in the marketplace. Think about the virtue of service, for example. You know, what do I learn about serving from, you know, my work in the marketplace? Well, I think quite a bit. I mean, think about the business person who tries to be successful without cultivating that virtue. part of what I think we miss is the way that just activity in the marketplace both requires and nurtures some of those really important virtues. I mean, try being a salesperson without the virtue of persistence, perseverance. I mean, not to mention try being a doctoral student without that. But the average business person without perseverance. I mean, my neighbor works in sales for Microsoft. And he'll pursue these clients for, you know, over a year, before finally signing a deal with them. And without that virtue, he's sunk as in his position. And there's a variety of other virtues that are both required by and nurtured. I remember Dallas Willard saying, cultivating the fruit of the Spirit actually makes you a better employee. It makes you better in the marketplace because if given your choice between hiring somebody who exhibits the fruit of the Spirit or the deeds of the flesh, who would you rather have work for you? Right, that's not even close. And I don't think there's anything problematic about the application, you know, expressing the application in our preaching and teaching of these in strictly marketplace terms. I think our business professional folks need to know that there are advantages in the marketplace that often accrue to having some of the biblical virtues. Right? Now, not that that's the ultimate motive, of course, but I think that's a really helpful expression of general revelation and common grace to know that those virtues actually make you a better employee.
Uzo Mittelmann, who is Francis Schaeffer's son-in-law, and this actually applies to what we've been saying the whole weekend. When the Iron Curtain fell, he called a number of us together to McLean, Virginia, and had about 50 of us. And he was trying to recruit people to go into Siberia to teach the Jesus film or to show the Jesus film and lead discussions. And it was the invitation of the Russian Education Commission or something like that. And there were former communist education czars out in Siberia who were not believers. But they said, we've noticed that our Christian teachers here, they're better. He says, they do their lessons. They show up for work. They're not drunk. They don't pilfer. They don't abuse the students. Whatever that is, we need more of that stuff. Come in and make more Jesus people because it really helps the school system. And they were just kind of, they weren't on board with the doctrine, but it's kind of like the lady that went to the psychiatrist and says, my husband thinks he's a chicken, and can you do anything? And he said, oh, yeah, I think we can manage it, and so forth. She said, well, yeah, but not so fast. We need the eggs. And so I think that there is that testimony of just great service that gets out there.
Yeah.
And it's not as though they got together in Siberia and said, let's make a special effort to impress the authorities. It's just they were being Christians.
I asked the director of our film school at Biola, how does he account for the remarkable hiring record of our film school graduates in the entertainment industry? You know what he said? He said, they show up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which what he meant by that was that they show up when they say they're going to be there. They show up on time. They have character, what he's suggesting. Yes. That's a good preoccupation.
Yeah. tried to set a system on a, what they call a cost accounting system, right? So the idea that everything is just based on what it really costs, okay? It's virtuous. It's just what it costs. And
what a concept.
Yeah, but he said that they still had to build in margin. They had to build in a margin in case there were failures, and they had to build in margin to fund research to do different things. And effectively, what we would call that margin is profit.
something like that. Yeah.
That's the point. Because you know, there's value to profit. Right.
Right. And see, and that's where I think, you know, it's just, it's not a complicated concept to recognize, you know, where does the funding for altruism, you know, where does that come from? It's not an accident that the most economically developed countries are also the most generous. And I mean, that there's a relatively simple explanation for that. And that the capacity for the creation of wealth does lead to things like materialism, that's true, consumerism, but it also fosters altruism and generosity, which is, I think, the other side of that coin that rarely gets mentioned. And clearly, materialism is, I would say, is more a matter of the heart than a matter of the economic system. But it is, I get how it's fostered more in systems that generate wealth. I think that's a fair concern about the ability of the market system to generate the kind of wealth that it does.
I'm curious, Scott, our institutions are somewhat similar. You and Biola probably where they're at in a lot of ways. And
no, I asked. Most of my students have never heard of him.
Yeah. But it is that framework in a very inchoate way. And so I'd be curious, Greg, if you all have thought about undergraduate, besides this work at the semi level, because
I
went to an active thing in 1994. Yeah. I was already there for lots of reasons and all that. But for our students who are great students, they're wonderful, their heart's in the right place, it is such an uphill battle just to kind of shift the ship at that group. I'm curious, in your work with students at Biola, is there one nugget that you kind of found helpful as a professor to say, hey, you might want to think about this, or here's a great YouTube video, or here's a great essay to help me? Just curious as a professor.
Yeah, we see that our undergrad student. I'm glad you raised that question for Greg, actually. That's because you're not the first one to do that.
I think that's
So, because I think, you know, our seminary students come from the ranks of undergrads.
That's right.
They have to unlearn some things when they come to school. I think the theologically oriented critiques of the market system that I think have been largely generated by Sider and Jim Wallace and, you know, the Sojourners community, in my view, they've made significant progress, and the economic downturn and the skepticism that brought about the free market gave aid, I gave aid and comfort to the theologically oriented critiques of the market. And I think we made a strategic error, I think, when we assumed that with the fall of the Berlin Wall, the debate over the market system was basically over. That was a huge mistake. But what we discovered in the aftermath of that was that the debate over the market system got way more intense, precisely because it was the only system left standing. And so the critics were, I think, even more concerned with not giving it a pass. So I think with our undergrads, you know, our students are probably a bit like yours. We still get a fairly conservative bunch, but it's in matters of economics where the cracks in that show first. Some of this I think we can sort of write off to the fact that they're, you know, still young and inexperienced, and there's a certain amount of virtue that comes as a result of being beat up by the world. And I think a certain hard-headedness about it that comes from that. And so, you know, with a lot of our students, I'm willing to kind of let the jury still be out on them. But what I try to do is to hit the primary criticisms of the market, and we've got basically got sound bites, you know, to help them. What they're most concerned about is the charges of greed materialism and the inequality that it fosters. Okay? So the sound bites we say is that, you know, greed and materialism are fundamentally matters of the heart, not the economic system. You have greedy people in every economic system. In fact, I think you can probably make an argument that where resources were most scarce, greed and materialism are actually the worst. And where there are no opportunities to move up the economic ladder, envy is clearly heightened, because that's the only that's the only thing you have. That's why in the scripture, the opposite of contentment is not ambition. The opposite of contentment is envy. Because one of the characteristics of that zero-sum view of economic life in the ancient world was that you were stuck in the socioeconomic class in which you were born into. I mean, there were no rags-to-riches stories. And so envy, that's all you got when you start looking up. And so with the inequality part, Wallace, I think, got a lot of press for saying God hates inequality. I mean, he said that in the halls of Congress, actually. And I think that, you know, what we tell our students is that what God hates is inequality that's the result of injustice, not natural inequality. Because, you know, there are lots of natural inequalities that nobody seems to get particularly bent out of shape about. You know, I could train for the rest of my life, but I am not a freak of nature that seems to be required to be an Olympic swimmer. I was out in the pool last night, and it was a good thing there was a lifeguard there. But I am never going to swim like Michael Phelps, and that's, you know, but nobody seems to lose a lot of sleep over that. But it's the inequalities that are the result of injustice that we ought to be losing sleep about, and which I think that if you read the prophets carefully, that's the inequality that they were exercised about, because these gross inequalities that were the result of the poor essentially being oppressed were what they got exercised about. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, it's great. Your reflections, thank you.
Okay, yeah.
Oh, great. Totally agree. I especially liked your walk through history.
I'd say it was more a sprint.
Yeah.
Well, I think it, in the New Testament, they got it right. But I think, you know, clericalism set in pretty soon in church history. And I think part of the reason it did had to do with actually the zero-sum view of economic life, because the question, you know, not only was the question, you know, how do we serve the poor, but the corollary to that, which was, I think, an equally pressing question, was how on earth do the rich get saved? If the means of acquiring wealth was so faith-compromising, which it normally was, that question starts getting raised, you know, right at the end of the first century, into the beginning of the second century. That dichotomy emerges pretty early on. And there are a lot of different reasons for that. One of the reasons I think it is so stubborn, and one of the reasons my students have difficulty challenging it in their churches, is that it is reinforced. There's an ego component, that there's a lot riding on that hierarchy, it seems to me. I'm encouraged that there are, you know, I mean, I think there were periods of history, I think right after the Reformation, you know, we got that right. I don't know how long that lasted, but you...
I know I commended it already, but that issue of Christian History Magazine...
That's good.
...has a lot of good signposts to people, including in eras that we don't normally think about. So there are German mystics in the Middle Ages who actually have a surprisingly advanced theology of vocation. And nobody's heard of these, except for specialists in medieval history. Nobody's heard of these guys, but they had these insights.
Yeah, that's a good reference. Thanks.
I was wondering, can I...
Yeah.
I want to come back to Peter Drucker, who had that insight about profit. It's not widely appreciated today, but Peter Drucker was a believer. And he was...
I've wondered if he finished out that way. Do you know?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I mean, it seems clear to me in his early writings that he's definitely a believer. Yeah.
Okay, that's something I don't know, but I think it's interesting that... believer who clearly understood that his principles of business were aligned with Christianity is widely credited as the father of modern management.
You're here.
Bill Pollard, who you mentioned before as the most theologically astute businessman you know, was discipled somewhat by Peter Drucker and likes to tell a story about a business trip to Japan he was on where he got treated unfairly and was kind of consumed by resentment. And Peter Drucker pulled him aside and said, "You've got to repent of this resentment," because Bill was ready to get on a plane and go home. And so Bill continues to tell the story of how Peter kind of rebuked him for his resentment and told him, "No, you've got to stick with this and return good for evil," and that some very wonderful things came out of his willingness to do that. One other thing I want to stick in on, so that's an illustration of how when we are faithful, we serve our communities better. Sort of Drucker inventing modern management in alignment with Christianity and forming that is a good example. The great exception to that, where good Christians become bad employees, is when the organization is ethically challenged at its roots. When the rot begins at the top and the organization has no understanding of how what it does contributes to the common good, then Christians become very bad employees. My favorite illustration of this, there's a movie that came out a while back called Glengarry Glen Ross, based on a play by David Mamet, and the center of the drama is if you try to be a good person in that workplace, you can't succeed.
Yeah.
Success requires ethical compromise in that workplace, and what Mamet brings out in the story is that's because what they are doing is unethical.
Right.
And it may not appear to be at first, but the more you begin to understand what this business is. It's actually, the business itself is a scam.
That's right.
And that's why nobody can succeed in the business unless they are a scoundrel. And I think he just brilliantly constructs the story to bring all of that out. But, you know, that other than that kind of exceptional circumstance, I'd strongly affirm that.
Yeah, and that's actually the reason why we encourage our business students to aspire to positions of leadership and influence, to where they can set the, where they can have a say in setting the culture. I would show Glenn Gary, Glenn Ross in my class, except the language is pretty bad. I can't do that at Biola. So. That would have, we'd be bleeping most of it.
Right.
Yeah, that's not. Yes.
To follow up something Brad said earlier, so maybe encouraging Greg, whatever. As far as the undergraduates, along the way in our discussions about trying to encourage more substantive preaching and church that's not entertainment driven, but more substantive and healthy, and so we're training pastors to pursue that. One thing that's become clear is, yes, we need to train pastors who are going to pursue this and lead this, but we're not training people in the pews to affirm it and help it, so that when somebody says, let's go this way, he doesn't get run out of town.
That's right.
It's not going to happen.
That's right.
The same way, there are business people who are longing for pastors to say, hey, this means something, but it's so rooted as well that it sounds like an alien idea and it'd be resistance. We really need things informing our aspiring business. We need a number of things at the undergraduate level, so that when leaders say this, there's some
resonance. Yeah, because my Asian students are a great example of that. Because they can't, they can't do this without their jobs being threatened. And I've actually had some of my Asian seminary students will tell me that the business people in their churches actually don't want this, because they want to be left alone by their pastors to go to do business however they want and to take clients to strip clubs and all that stuff. Some of this is there's cultural components on this too that make it challenging. But I think that's right, which is why I'm grateful that a place like Biola, we've got a business school. That's informed by some of these theological convictions, and hopefully that's contributing. And as long as we get the rest of the university to affirm those things too, yeah.
Another quick example: when I was,
I got to be careful of your examples here, brother.
I was teaching at Wheaton. Our music director in our church was in our little church in Glen Ellen. Very good friend. He worked with telephone systems called Rolm Company, R-O-L-M, and he was really hot. I mean, I think he got to retire at 35 with a gazillion dollars or something like this. But at any rate, we were having supper one night. Afterwards, we went up for church, pizza after church every Sunday night. And we were saying, well, what'd you do this week, Mike? And he said, well, he made a big sale out at some suburban Chicago deal, and he sold systems for whole buildings, not just individual phone tips. And he said, I had to create a situation. And I said, well, what's that, Mike? And he said, well, the guy needed our system, and of course the sale, we needed that. And he just wasn't moving. He was just a waffling fella. So we had to create a situation. I had to tell him that prices were going up October 1st, and he got off his dime and he bought the system. They weren't going up October 1st, but I helped him along. And so he was like a lay leader in our church, but that's business, And it's like, really? You lied. Come on. But they do love to insulate that. It's like,
yeah.
Jesus knows like shepherds and Romans, but this is business. And it's crazy.
Yeah, I love that. In the South, it's business in the South. Yeah. Not always. I think some of that's healthy. I think they need to be aware of their own vulnerability to that. But I think, in my view, we have an undue skepticism about the possession of wealth in our communities. I mean, again, some of the godliest people I know have, way more money than I could ever spend. But they're also some of the most generous people I know, and they seem to have navigated that pretty well. Whether they're the exception to the rule, that's harder to say. But I know we have lots of Christian business people who they apologize for their level of wealth, which I think that's unfortunate when they do that.
Yeah. That Dallas Willard wrote an essay in the Spirit of Disciplines, where he's not so subtly critiquing his protege, Richard Foster. And it's a great essay because he actually challenges Wesley on work all you can, give all you can. And Willard said, the last of that triad, you might want to think twice about, because if you actually retain some, you're able to use that wisely over a long period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, point well taken. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I was just curious if you thought, because it seems to me that a lot of undergraduates aren't really convinced of it until they experience something either national, even with the economic downturn. I think they saw that as the result of greed and materialism, not as the result of a healthy market system. In our, I'll put myself in that situation, in that category, in our generation, we haven't necessarily experienced the other vice. We seem to see materialistic, greedy, which we do associate with the market system itself. Now, I do think I've read enough to where I'm not necessarily there, but I was just curious if after you say, oh, yeah, it's disconnected, the students just buy into that, or is there still a lot to do?
Well, yeah, like any soundbite needs to be nuanced, because I think they need to be aware that of their vulnerability, to those things. But I think what we try to do is to say that's not an indictment on the system. That's an indictment on your heart. That seems to go a long way. That distinction, I think, is generally really helpful. Thank you.
I agree. We need to call people into every area of life, and we need to call them to be faithful Christians in those areas of life. The church I pastored, I started as a pastor in the suburb of Denver, was a white-collar community. I had the presidents, CEOs, CFOs, people, rising, climbing the ladder in a hurry. And, we benefited from everything that they were developing in their own business setting. We benefited from them in the church. Mm-hmm. They brought incredible expertise to us in the church. And then we also helped contribute to their ability to do their work in their businesses. I often had questions about, especially different kinds of business ethics. How does the Bible apply in these areas? The church better come alongside these.
That's right.
Men and women, as they're trying to figure out how to be faithful Christians and guide a business in a very sexual libertarian environment. We need to figure out how to help them be successful. But the other thing that I think students need to do is simply be exposed to these successful businessmen and businesswomen and hear their heart. My general experience has been that the manipulators, the guys who like to cut the corners, they make it somewhere in the middle of management, but they don't make it to the top because the boards don't trust those kind of people. The guys who actually make it into the CEO's chair are the guys that the boards actually believe they can trust. They're the guys that they're willing to put in charge of the livelihood of that business and the future of that business. And I think that capable, committed Christian man or woman just brings that level of credibility with them into that environment. That's why I think they oftentimes do so well.
It seems to me one of the benefits of a business school and a Christian university is putting business into an ethical framework, and getting students to believe that they can actually maintain their faith, maintain their virtue, and succeed in the marketplace at the same time. I think, I mean, your point is right. I think they're in the, I think in the business community in general, there's widespread skepticism about that. And I think a lot of Christian business people in my church, for example, aren't too sure about that if you really push them on it. And granted, there are exceptions. I think in the short run, I think being ethical is usually costly. Otherwise, if that were not true, then everybody would be ethical all the time. You know, and we wouldn't, my books on business ethics would be out of print. But I think in the long run, I think you can make a much better argument for that on the virtue of trust and trustworthiness that I think is really important. And although I think it's probably not right to say that companies are in the character formation business, they are certainly in the character screening business with their employees. And I think that has been heightened in the last few years, probably in the last 15 years, in the aftermath of all the stuff in the early 2000s and then with the financial crisis. And I think that element of trust and trustworthiness is huge. Not so much for people in doing their jobs as much. Like I think there are lots of jobs that you can do where your character probably doesn't matter as much. But when we talk about to our students about, you know, you entering positions of leadership, if the people you are leading don't trust you, you are finished. And that's why I think that observation, I think, is right. And we've had, you know, a fairly sizable handful of folks come into our classes who are at the top of their organizations, who they just tell the students flat out, once you lose the trust of your employees, you've lost your ability to lead them.
Or the board.
Well, especially of the board, yeah. And my partner and I teach business ethics. We role play a scenario where we've got a character challenged CEO who's been very charismatic and successful. And we role play the character challenge CEO because both of us know the kind of character that he represents. Although I feel like I sort of have to take a shower afterwards. But the students are the board, and what it always comes back to is that, you know, we have to be able to trust you. If we try to manipulate them all sorts of different ways, and at the end of the day, that's what comes out. And if we can't trust you, you know, your ability to lead is done. I remember the woman who was the former editor of the Harvard Business Review, who actually wrote the article on which our role play was based. She was the one who, when this was some time ago, when she was doing a series of interviews for the review, she was interviewing Jack Welch. She ended up starting an affair with him, and she ended up marrying him. You know, and remember that when they appeared on 60 Minutes together or something, and they said to Welch, I certainly see what you see in her, but they asked her, I don't see what you see in him. But she ended up, as a result of that affair, in the midst of doing those interviews, she ended up resigning from her editorship of the review because, as she put it, her staff had lost confidence in her ability to lead, because of her inability to manage these conflicts of interest. Once she had lost their trust, that it was over. And as you know, trust is that takes a long time to build and not long to disintegrate. And she's a really good example. And it was, you know, it was front page news in the business section when she resigned. Yeah.
Is that his current wife?
Yes. Is that right? I'm glad to hear that. I'm very encouraged to hear that. Yeah, Susie Welch. Yeah.
He's a very good friend, by the way. I work for a website called Kairos Journal, and it's funded by the retired CEO of American Standard Corporation, toilets, drain, air conditioning, so forth. And he is a super strong believer, and Welch quotes him, cites him in some of his books. His name is Emmanuel Concours, and they have.
Yeah.
And he's talked about
That's very interesting. I'm glad to know that, actually. Very glad to hear that. See, this, well, I'll stop with this. I'm getting the word from Ken here. This is ultimately the reason why we have to do this well, is because the business community is, I think, the one of the few segments of culture today where there's a really sizable, influential Christian presence. We dare not lose that. Anyway, thank you, guys. Thank you.